This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders, past and present.
This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters Series. Today's guest is one Catherine and I have been keen to interview since the very start of the podcast back in 2018, when we started hearing about a debut book by an Australian author which was generating a whole lot of buzz. Then we saw this author's photo shoot in which she sat in a room filled with native Australian flowers, one of the subjects of her debut novel, and we thought, wow, this woman and her team know what they are doing. Then that debut book came out and the rest, as they say, is history. Holly Ringland is a writer, storyteller, and television presenter. Her award-winning, best-selling debut novel, The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, has been published in 31 countries and will stream globally in 2023 as a seven-part series on Amazon Prime, starring Sigourney Weaver. In 2019, Lost Flowers won the Australian Book Industry Awards General Fiction Book of the Year and won Ringland adoring fans, many of whom tattooed Holly's flower language on their own skin. She inspires that level of fandom, and we chat about it in this conversation. Throughout 2020, Holly travelled Australia to film the ABC series Back to Nature with Aaron Peterson. She also bought a 1968 Olympic Riviera caravan named Frenchie to become her writing office based on Yugumba land, southeast Queensland. And there she wrote her new book, The Seven Skins of Esther Wilding, which is out now. Listeners, I tried to cut our convo down, but Holly is just so full of story and awe and curiosity and full-hearted generosity. I knew you would want all of her words. I hope you enjoy. Holly Ringland, your glorious face is on my screen and I'm so excited. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Kate Mildenhall, likewise. Thank you for having me on the First Time Podcast. You guys do amazing things to support writers and I feel very excited and jittery and bewildered that I get to be on it talking to you. So thank you.
Let's just be jittery together. I'm going to ground us and we're going to go back. So we like to talk about beginnings here. And yeah. I know that you wanted to be a writer from the age of three. I want you to tell us, Holly, about Holly the child and the young person and what she was writing and reading and imagining.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Instantly my body relaxes. You know what you're doing, Ms. Mildenhall. You're going to ground us and look at it happening. Thank you for that invitation to think about her. My mum gave me the gift of reading when I was, as you said, when I was three, but she was reading to me from the time I was born. It was just at three that I'd figured out enough words and had enough understanding that humans made books. And if a human was making books, then I wanted to do what that human was doing, because I just loved what happened. Not that I had the knowledge or consciousness of this at 3 years old, but I was besotted. My earliest memories are of being besotted with the pictures in my head and what happened when Mum would open a book that never happened at any other time. Even if I was watching Sesame Street or Play School, something different happened when Mum opened a book and started to read to me. And of course, it was my imagination working. So Mum did the thing that Alice Hart's mum does in Alice's world, which is where I got it from. My mum labelled everything in the house. And before I could handwrite, after I was three, and I'd said to Mum, I want to be a writer, before I was at school and could handwrite, my beautiful mum would dictate. I would stomp around the lounge room with a wooden spoon in my conductor's arm, and I would make up stories and Mum would handwrite them as I dictated them, because then I could see I suppose Mum's motivation was to show me how it became, how an oral story became a tangible story that you could hold, because she was feeding that thing that I'd told her that I wanted to be a writer. So as I got older, I was always a pretty bubbly kid. I had a complicated childhood, but I was always a pretty bubbly kid. But I think I was a extroverted introvert, mm-hmm. because I, you know, so much of my time was spent in my own head, and there was so much happening in my own head, stories and visions and ponderings that never were articulated or verbalized. So as I got older, those things started to fuse with emotions as I came into my feelings, mm-hmm. and as, you know, hormones started to kick in late childhood. And something I always heard around me, even if it was never said to me, was, gosh, she's got big feelings, doesn't she? You know, she's like, or the, you know, death knell, well, she's a bit sensitive, isn't she? And so that's called fun.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But the way that I saw story never changed. It only got more powerful. Mm. And then as a teenager, one of my first jobs I got was at a video store. Remember those things?
Love it. Of course you did, Holly. Of course you did.
And so through the sort of second half of high school and then into uni, I worked at a video store where I got free movie rentals. So I lived on visual story as well as the stories I was reading. And I think it's taken me a really long time to realize that not everybody sees the world in the same narrative way, and certainly doesn't feel their way through the world in the same way, which is not at all to say I'm so unique, I'm so special. It's more like when you're younger and you don't have any idea about emotional diversity, you think that everybody is experiencing things in the same way. And that's who I was as a kid, and where writing and imagination and feelings intersected, I think.
Tell me, Holly, how was, I imagine, and I think I've read that writing was a real constant for you, has been an absolute constant for you. How was what you were writing over that time, and as you're building this kind of new visual language and the emotional intelligence, how was what you were writing changing? What were you writing about?
Okay, so when I was my stories as a kid very much emulated what I was reading. So I was writing fairy tales about frogs choking up golden balls in gardens with castles. Then I went through a phase, had no idea that this was what it was, but I went through a phase of Babysitter's Club fan fiction.
Of course.
And then, of course, dabbling in Sweet Valley High, Elizabeth and Jessica Wakefield.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sort of mirroring, my output was what my input was.
Yeah.
And I was mirroring those stories and exploring, and I hated choose your own adventure books because I couldn't handle the pressure of the choice. So
it is so telling.
I couldn't handle the pressure of the choice, and I couldn't handle committing to a choice.
Mm-hmm.
So when faced with a choice, I would read all options and then make my decision.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about writing that I loved when I was emulating what I was reading is that I could make the choice without knowing any other option. You know, I wasn't, you know, that having that narrative control, not that that's what I knew it was, but it felt so wonderful to have the magic wand in my hand and to be dictating where the story was going. I guess my writing continued that way, and nobody ever read it. It wasn't like, I mean, I think there are occasions where I may have performed something with my cousins, and our tickets for the performance were like cassette tapes that everyone had to hand in the lounge room.
Love it.
But then I'm thinking around 94, 95, I was 14, 15, all the body parts, the thumping, things are changing, dynamics, social things are changing. And I started writing my first novel. I was deeply in love with and mourning River Phoenix, like lived with the wound feeling open in my chest and very big, vivid teenage feelings. Like I was the poster girl for those, for that scenario. And I started writing a novel. I think it was inspired by one of his films that he starred in called Running on Empty, which was about an activist family on the run and like the torture and the angst of this, because in the film he meets Martha Plimpton and like there's this, you know.
I am feeling your 14-year-old feelings just watching you remember this.
And so I started writing this novel. And what I remember about it was, it was, I think I took it from sort of inspired by the Martha Plimpton character in Running on Empty, who was the well-to-do upper-class sort of musician, if I'm remembering rightly. And I started this novel, and it was this sort of young girl that had all this privilege, and her mother was like a movie star that had sort of no time for her, and they lived in a mansion that was Hollywood, but it was on the Gold Coast. And then like one of the wait staff that came to the party was like, enter River Phoenix. You know, not that like I called him River Phoenix, but this is what I'm seeing in my mind.
Of course.
And this novel, sort of this sort of Romeo and Juliet vibe, this novel sort of started unraveling, like I was writing it and unraveling, and then all of a sudden like it got quite like political and espionage, and then it turned into like a pseudo Billy and Erica from Baywatch love affair from the 90s. And Kate, it was like 200,000 words long.
Oh, Holly.
And I had no concept of whether or not it needed to be, quote, good.
Mm-hmm.
I had no concept of technical. I had no concept of exposure or of criticism or critique. Or it was pure joy, as in Mum would come into my bedroom on a weekend afternoon when I'm a 15-year-old, and I'd just be sitting there at my 400-kilo secondhand IBM that I was so lucky to have, just clacking away, because I was living the pictures in my head, which I'm sure was helping me to deal with being a teenager. And that's sort of, those are my vivid memories of how my writing changed. And
wow.
And then in my 20s, I learned, well, I didn't learn. In my 20s, it just felt like self-doubt just careened in, gatecrashed the party. I mean, I had self-doubt as a teenager for sure, but writing was seemed to be immune to it. I mean, it's just a silly understatement to say I had self-doubt. Like being 15 is painful enough.
Yeah.
So then in my 20s, I became aware of, if you want to be a writer, there's an industry and there's a world. That outside gaze really came in. So then writing became something really private, like as in, you know, I sort of didn't really show anyone. I didn't talk about it too much. It started to sink in how impossible it would ever be that I might actually become a writer. And the feeling more started to fill me as I got older. And the trauma that the unprocessed trauma I had lived with for years started to catch up to me. And the context there that I've been open about since Lost Flowers came out is I've lived a lot of my life with male perpetrated violence. And, you know, as any of us who have been through trauma or grief know, there can be a long, indefined period of time where you don't even know that you're traumatized, because you are just trying your best to outrun what you don't want to face and to survive and to be happy and have a good life and be a good person. And you don't realize that the hypervigilance and panic that you live with every day is not perhaps a usual state of being. So that all fed into my writing in my 20s. It was like, oh my God, I'm not, oh, there's a whole industry here. I'm never going to be good enough for this. Like, so that joy of teenagehood faded and became sort of dusty dream stuff. And the desire to be a writer was this tiny little kernel that just sort of burned in my chest. And I just didn't, there were so many times in my 20s where I just thought, this will be the thing that this will be my regret when I'm old, you know, when I'm granny's age, is this is what I knew I always wanted to do, and I just wasn't ever good enough to do it, to try it.
Holly, what was the turning point when that little burning kernel became so intense that you had to start setting down what was, I imagine, Alice Hart, or was it something before that?
No, it was the kernel carried on. I mean, after when I was 29, what I vowed to myself would be the last violent relationship that I would ever have in my life ended. I left the relationship and it broke my heart and it broke me in two, because part of the problem is I didn't want it to be over. And of course, that's in my experience the reason why you stay. But something deeper, I'd run the gauntlet enough, and something deeper knew that I, you know, it was getting to the point where I had to save my own life on many levels. And I had the financial privilege. I had savings. I'd been working and saving. I had the financial privilege and ability to do that, to leave. And when I faced this sort of ground zero of my life, because I'd left my job, my home, my community, and I thought, what am I going to do? How am I going to survive this? This little kernel was like, hi, are you going to pay attention to me now? I was 29. I didn't have a mortgage. I wasn't married. I didn't have anything I didn't have a responsibility that tethered me geographically to Australia. And a beautiful friend of mine, I went around to her place for dinner, and I was talking about how confused I felt about what to do with myself, because I mean, at that point, everything was confusing. And she said, look, you're talking about writing, you're talking about maybe traveling. Why don't you do both? What is stopping you from doing both? And it was one of those occasions where your friends like deliver the angel's message, you know? So cut to, I applied to go and do my master's in creative writing in the UK. I'd never been to the UK. I knew no one. I moved there on my own, not because I thought that going to study writing at the university level would make me a writer. It was the cradle that I needed to hold me. I needed something. I needed validation. I needed something to lean on while I tried to put myself and my life back together. So that was the first kernel explosion. But then, you know, sadly, life isn't that, you know, in my 14-year-old's novel, that would have been where I walked into the sunset and was like, you know, welcomed into open arms by England going, oh, and now your dream comes true. But I got to England and 5 years later, I'd done my master's in creative writing and I still felt like I was choking. The story was here. And what was choking me was a compacted life of fear, that whose job, like fear's job is to keep us safe, right? Don't take a risk. What if you fail? So I was choked by fear. I was choked by just completely non-existent self-worth. But at the same time, I had the guts and gumption to have gotten myself to that point in my life. So that contrast was coming up against each other. The big crack, the big explosion when the kernel finally sort of burst into life. I mean, it took watching somebody in my family who I loved dying in front of me. It took death. It took seeing him take his last breath and not breathing again. And the magnitude of that moment, I had never been with anybody that I loved who had died before, not dog, not human, not any being that I loved. And when this sort of big, when this person, this big part in my life died, the thundering realization that went through me in the days that followed was how boring fear was. And in the madness of grief, because all it does is just say stop. It doesn't say, oh, maybe you could try if you do this. It's just like, remembering Get Smart? Remember those like iron walls? And like didn't one close on like like that's in my mind, that fear is just constantly that wall. It's very black and white. There's no gray. There's like, oh, maybe, at least in my experience with this kind of fear that I'm talking about, that just has this hold on sort of so much of your life. And I, in the madness of grief in those early months after he died, we were back at home in our house in England. I met my partner, Sam, in Manchester. I think he is the reason why I went to England. And we were back home in our house and Sam had gone to work. He worked for a charity at the time and I was home alone. And I was in that raw edge of grief where you're not sure if you want to howl or tear your hair out or, and I, this person who died in my family was such a big supporter. He used to listen to me talk and he'd say, are you writing this down? Why aren't you doing anything with these stories? And the last thing that he said to me, he knew that I was really battling and on the cusp of wanting to write my first novel. I'd been trying, there were many attempts, but I hadn't gotten there. And he said to me before he died, you will write this book. And if you can't do it for yourself, you will do it for all of us who have invested ourselves in you.
Holy.
And I was thinking about that and I went into my office and the important part of this story, because I've told this a few times, people ask about this moment, but it was when I decided, it was the most important part of the story is the decision that I made where I sat there and I thought, what happens if you just try for 10 minutes to not listen to, you can't do this as the first thing that you hear when you sit down at the page? What happens if you remember that 4 and 5 year old with the wooden spoon talking about frogs and golden balls and castles and enchanted waters? What happens if you come from that place rather than the, you know, the place that you've been listening to for 15 years? I was 34 years old and I thought that, because that hasn't gotten you anywhere, Ringland, like, where's the novel? It's not on paper. And I think it was the madness of grief that gave me the courage to finally step over what was the chokehold or to rip it off my neck. And I sat down and I opened my notebook and I just took a really deep breath and I looked out the window and I think I dissociated a little bit because in my memory I was watching my hand write. It didn't feel like I was embodied. And I watched my hand write the first, what became the first sentence of Alice Hart. Yeah.
It is a magical story and it fills me with all kinds of feelings, Holly Ringland. I want to move from that because in some senses that sounds like the fairy tale, the you know, it bursts open and it bursts out of you. Yeah. And then this blissful book kind of writes itself and then goes out into the world. And I know that that's not true. And I think that there's a gorgeous post on Instagram about, which I think I read a long time ago, about how an initial submission for Alice Hart didn't even make the cut. So you've written the novel. No. You're like, I have done this thing. You put it into an unpublished manuscript award and it, nothing. So what did it take to go from that moment of that first sentence to get it out there in the world? What did it take?
Sort of in a way with full awareness that it's not world peace. I'm not curing cancer. I'm not saving babies. Like with full awareness of that, it is the hardest. Writing Lost Flowers was the hardest thing I have ever done. And it nearly killed me on so many levels because before I wrote Lost Flowers, I'd never even uttered the phrase out loud, male perpetrated violence. Mm. There was so much I'd never, ever voiced. There was so much lived experience and emotional truth in my life I had never looked at because, as we said before, how can you bear to look at that if you're also trying to move in a forward or sideways direction? Like even if you're stuck in your life, you still need sort of some kind of movement. And trying to walk the line between, because Lost Flowers is, it is not an autobiography. It's not a memoir. I was not 3 years old and said to Mum, I want to become a memoirist. Like, and I've never been great at journaling. I don't journal because I find it, for me, it's too repulsive. Like I'm repulsed by the act of needing to put my fact on the page. And I think that probably comes from so many years hiding from what I couldn't bear to face. About having had this life and being alive. And so walking this line to write Alice Hart was walking a line between reflecting and not reliving. And I think I failed most days because the book is drawn, you know, I think the thing about fiction that I have instinctively loved since I was a wee thing is that it's emotionally true. That's what myth, folklore, and fairy tale is. It's emotionally true. It's filled with warnings and chaos and strife and love and metaphorical magic. And so I filled Lost Flowers with all of the emotional truth that I didn't have anywhere else for it to go. And it had never had anywhere else to go. It had lived in my body. I was 34, like I said, when I started writing it. I'd been carrying it around all my life. But to get it from my body to the page, I wasn't prepared for it. Like I had no idea. And it was like in a personal context, it was real agony, you know, but a sense of humor, I think, is one of the most powerful things that we have to save us from ourselves as often as possible. And, you know, there would be mornings where I would get up and I would sort of lie on our bed in my bathrobe with like the tears rolling backwards down my throat and like down the sides of your face. And Sam, you know, who has got such great, like, we have, like, that was one of the things that I immediately loved about him, is we have the same sense of humor. And he was lying beside me and sort of like giving me a comforting rub on the arm. And he was like, you know, babe. So, you know, you hear that tone from your partner and you're thinking, okay, here comes the support. And he's like, I just think you should give up. Like, just give up. Like, you know, just, babe, don't do it. Don't do it. And I looked at him and he has this particular twinkle in his eye and the corner of his mouth was twitching. And I was like, oh my God, you and you give up. You don't fuck yourself. And so then I got up with my tea and off I went to the, and he, you know, and he said to me, what would it feel like if you took the foot of pressure off your chest and you just went into your office today and wrote a scene with Alice Hart that brings you joy, that you, that maybe doesn't carry on from where you're working, but so it was a constant line to walk. And it was really hard, Kate. Like, but in that, like, every novel is hard. Every writer that I know says, oh my God, that one was really hard. And, you know, with full awareness, as I said, that it, like, it's everything and it's nothing all at once. But it took its pound of flesh for me, that's for sure. But I had it. This thing I thought I wasn't good enough to do, after I'd finished the novel, I had a whole novel written on paper. It existed. And that feeling was, it's a little bit like after period pain has passed and then a couple of weeks later you can't remember how bad the pain is.
Yeah.
And then you're getting your period again. You're like, what's wrong with me?
What is this thing?
What is this? That amnesia. And then, yeah, I thought to myself, okay, I think I've got a pretty good, and I mean, a few people had read the opening, like the first chapter or the first few chapters of Lost Flowers. And I can't remember if it was, I submitted the first 10,000 words, which was the first chapter. I submitted it to Griffith Review and it won their Writers Circle competition and it got me a fellowship at Verena House, which, I mean, I got the phone call on a packed gull bus traveling from Torquay to Melbourne Airport. And you know how small those buses are. And like, I think I dropped the C-bomb on the phone. Like, it was so, you know, and then I can't remember if it was before or after that in the timing, but I did submit like the first, it might have been the first three chapters or the first chapter. I can't remember that specific either, but I submitted this chunk to like one of Australia's big publishing Let's Find an Emerging Writer prize. Total tumbleweed, like not even a we're considering this or it's made it for the next. It's just I submitted it and then there was nothing. So that was like, will you press on? And by that stage it was like, well, fuck, I've come this far. I'm not going to put this in a drawer and walk away from it. Not when it took what it took to write it. I'm going to fight for it a little bit. And then I got my agent and then things got their own momentum from there.
They certainly did. I think that it's about that stage, Holly, that I must have started following you on Instagram. So I feel like I've had this very strange kind of watching of your journey, this public kind of version of it. But it's so extraordinary and so generous of you to kind of give this backstory, because the jump cut to this kind of bursting into the world of the Lost Flowers of Alice Hart and the kind of
momentum, as you say, and magic that came with that must have been incredibly discombobulating for you. So I want to ask, because there's so much to ask you about. So I thought I'd ask you just if you could share like one maybe unexpected highlight of what came next of this kind of crazy, amazing, you know, auction, publishing, all the rest of it, of what came next. What was one of the highlights?
I'm just going to go with the first one that comes to mind.
Please.
The novel had gone to auction in Australia. So it was 2017. I knew that HarperCollins were going to publish it in 2018. I was in the UK at the time, the London Book Fair. Up until this point, like I went to HarperCollins in Sydney on a trip home from the UK to Australia, and I'd met the HarperCollins team in the boardroom. I was so overcome, and this has become like the hallmark sort of, it's not even a personal joke because it's just the truth. I was so overcome that James Kellow, who was the CEO at the time at HarperCollins, who's now at Ultimo Press, he walked in to meet me, and like he was wearing this beautiful pressed, like I think it was Ralph Lauren shirt. And he sort of like gave me a hug, and I gave him a hug. And Kate, I left mascara and snot on his like business shirt. And after I got home from this meeting, just meeting the HarperCollins crew and sitting around this table with people in sort of the tower of HarperCollins publishing building, I got such a migraine. I couldn't get like out of bed for the rest of the day because I was so overcome. And there wasn't much public facing stuff after that. I went back to England with Sam for a bit. That was the end of 2016, beginning of 2017, the London Book Fair. Catherine Milne, my publisher, she flew over to come to the book fair for a number of reasons. My UK publisher, who'd acquired Alice by that stage, but we were about a year and a half out from publication anywhere. Pan Macmillan at the time, they were like, let's put on some author drinks for any of Holly's publishers that are at the London Book Fair, because the novel had sold in other territories as well, all of which my body, like my legs have gone to jelly just remembering this, because like my body understood and tried to process as much as I could that Alice was going to be published in Turkey and Italy and Holland. And I tried to get my head around that. I got a stress infection because my body couldn't discern joy from like cortisol. So Pan Macmillan says, let's have author drinks for Holly in London. So they had like 13 of my publishers come to the Pan Macmillan stand. And for anybody who doesn't know, because I didn't know what the London Book Fair was, it's only something that became part of my language once you go into this strange world of publishing and industry and the book market. Two big book fairs happen in the world each year, and it's London Book Fair and the Frankfurt Book Fair, and it's when agents and publishers get together and readers can go along as well, and it's just like a big mingling thing in one of those huge like trade hall, event hall things that every city has. So my partner Sam and I, we go to this drink thing, and Kate, I went to everybody started to gather, and like there were pictures of like they'd put pictures of my face up and welcome to drinks with hot. Oh, my legs are shaking. And I went to the toilet before I sort of walked in to meet everyone, and I shook so hard. It was more than my nervous system and my brain could try and understand. And just walking around with these human beings who had read the book I'd written alone in Manchester, who were now looking at me face to face and saying, we can't wait to translate this into Catalonian or French. Or I shook the whole time. And it was, you know, I kept on looking at Catherine across, Catherine and Sam were there, and I kept on looking at Catherine across the crowd, and my agents were there as well, and my European agents was there, and it was just constantly anchoring myself, because it's just a little bit like that moment in the movie when Charlie opens the chocolate bar and you see that flash of gold and you're like, fuck, it can't really be happening. It can't really be happening. So it was just, I guess that was like one of the biggest, that was one of the first and biggest mind-melting highlights that happened with the novel. And I think I'm still trying to figure out how to live and process and absorb, because it just doesn't happen all at once for me.
I want to talk about the readers that then Alice came to, because there's a couple of things. First, your incredible road trip down the east coast of Australia, which I tell people all the time, like, if this is within your capacity, you should just Holly Ringland it. Like, go down the east coast or whatever coast and visit every bookshop and meet the booksellers and meet the readers. So there was that aspect of it. And then this ongoing and extraordinary to witness, and I can't imagine how it's been for you, the idea that in Alice with the Flowers and in Esther Wilding, The Seven Skins of Esther Wilding, which we will get to talking about, I promise, this idea of adornment and adornment as strength and courage, and watching from the outside how women, particularly your readers, began to get the language of flowers tattooed on their bodies and tell you. And I feel like, you know, all of us who are writers have got some of those incredible kind of DMs that we get. But having someone, multiple people, many readers, tattoo the language that you have written of flowers onto their skin is just completely next level. So I want to ask you, what was that next step like, meeting with readers, hearing those responses, and how did you hold space for yourself in a time when so many readers were engaging with your work and wanted to engage with you, Holly Ringland, as well?
It was a little bit of a baptism of fire because before I started writing Lost Flowers, I did a lot of reading of Austin Kleon's work. And he has written for anyone that doesn't know, he's written the small, gorgeous, as in like physically small, beautiful to hold, gorgeous books, Steal Like an Artist, Show Your Work. And Steal Like an Artist is amazing. It's all about like how fluid ideas are and where inspiration comes from. But it was Show Your Work that left the mark on me because the message of that book about being an artist is, if you want the connection that you desire your work to have, you have to find the courage to be seen. That's the message that I took away from it. And it's that painful because for me, being seen was unsafe. Using my voice was unsafe. I wrote the book because I had a deep ache inside of myself for connection. But, you know, the thing about truths is that multiple truths in us as human beings can exist all at once. And one of my truths was, I want this story to live. I ache to connect with people. I feel like I've made myself small to stay safe for so long. And what if I sing? You know, I've read so many Jungian experts and giants on my bookshelves and fairy tale writers and other women writers that I look up to talk about, Will you sing the song inside of you? And what, you know, if you don't, it is to your peril that you will go, you know. So when Lost Flowers came out, I just hoped that someone would like it. I just hoped that it wouldn't sink. I had the hopes of any writer that is published where you have no idea what sea you're venturing into, but you hope that it will be good and wild and generous to you, but not overthrow you and not take you into the doldrums where there's no wind or movement at all. So that was my hope for Lost Flowers. I had absolutely no preparation or know-how or expectation, because I think the biggest thing that reared its head before publication was this utter terror again that I was going to be the emotional girl and that my writing was going to be flowery or sensitive and everybody was going to laugh at me or say, why would anybody publish this? God, what a blah, blah. Mm. And, you know, those are, and, you know, go off in any direction, you know, insecurity and self-doubt were just like, we're having a party over here. Just, you know, carry on. What ended up happening, because when I went out on this tour, this driving tour down the east coast of Australia, where I had the great gift of the time and space and resources to go and visit not only capital cities, but I mean, I should say HarperCollins had the resources. It wasn't a self-funded tour. I had the gift of being able to visit regional bookshops. And what I could not have been prepared for and what I you know, as I was driving from every town to town, and I would always usually have someone with me, I would think to myself, okay, we might go to this event tonight, and, you know, it's going to be okay if nobody shows up, you know, like we'll just end up going out for drinks with the bookshop owners and it's going to be fine. Like, it's not a reflection of your worth as a human being. It's going to be fine. But that didn't happen. And people showed up for me and for Alice Hart in, you know, country towns and cities. And I was no one. No one knew my name. And I still feel I'm on the edge of tears, and I still, like, am lost for words, because people came and came into my signing lines and listened to me talk and reached out for my hands and shared their stories with me. And the truth is, Kate, I don't think I held space for myself, because I had no preparation or idea how to. I just tried to respond instinctively in the moment and then sort of dealt with the burnout after tour and just sort of retreated after it was over for as long as I could to just try and get some recovery. Because it's also, while there's so much sort of emotional tax going on, it's also like the wildest dream and euphoria happening all meshed up in trauma and emotion and bittersweetness and human connection with people through stories. And so I think constantly the way I managed sort of the growing fatigue over tour was that I just constantly reminded myself that I was there by choice for joy. This fatigue I'm feeling is not punishment. This is not a traumatic event like the way my body understands fatigue from the past. This is a beautiful joy that I'm choosing to wake up every day and put on every possible native flower that I can to go into a bookshop and say, kind of with my energy, holy fuck, who can believe that this has happened? And yay. So it was kind of all of that going up at each other, going up against each other in one big, lots of multiple truths all at once time.
Anyone would have given you permission to, I think, to kind of go and rest for about, you know, 20 years after the experience that you had with Alice Hart. I was reading, and it struck me that this probably applied to you. I was reading Liz Gilbert, who said, I had to make sure my creativity survived its own success. And
so beautifully put.
It clearly has, because I'm holding this gorgeous book, The Seven Skins of Esther Wilding, in my hands, and it did. But I know that this must have been incredibly hard in a different way to gather yourself together again and gather this material that was obsessing and interesting for you and come back to return to the page and write again. How did you do that? Just small question, Holly.
I know. It's one that I sort of stare at the wall and ask myself every day at the moment. I think the first thing is that, and, you know, with the mother faults, I bet you went through this, right? Second novel. At points it feels like even like the sales checkout assistants at Woolies are like, hi, how's your day going? Oh, good luck with the second novel. Like, how are you going to write a second one? Like, it's the question of it becomes so omniscient that it feels like complete strangers that don't know you are looking at you going, you think you can do it again? You think you're going to write a second book? You know, that's how it kind of felt to me. And so something that I wouldn't have thought I would be capable of putting in place with myself was after Australian tour ended in 2018, the sort of end of 2018 and beginning of 2019 was continuing Alice's business. So it was opportunities from like my North American publisher to do a small, tiny little tour over there, and then things in the UK with my French and Norwegian publishers, opportunities that I didn't want to say no to over there. So Alice's business continued through 2019, but I started thinking about I didn't know her name was Esther at the time, but I started thinking about this woman and her story. And the thing that I possibly wouldn't have believed that I could do was make a commitment and a choice to myself. And I think it's probably the gift of doing, you know, the experience of something teaches you something about yourself that theory can't. And the experience of writing Lost Flowers, doing it, and then I might not always have done it well, but finding the courage to be seen with it and to show up as myself and to make the conscious choice to not hide from where the novel came from in me, because then I would just be contributing to the canon of silence.
Mm.
All of those things created in me a knowing about myself that I didn't have before, where if I set my mind to something, like, I am not going to be wasted. I am not going to let the next 5 years be wasted to the pressure or fear of writing a second novel. And I made that commitment to myself, and I didn't always succeed. There were some days where the fear of my second novel and how it would be received and what it would be like really got into my bones and my pores. So it's not like I made the decision and then that was that, I was ironclad, but I held that really close to me. And I knew very clearly that I wasn't setting out to try and emulate Alice Hart, and I wasn't setting out thinking this needs to be as successful / XYZ as Lost Flowers. I had learned enough and I knew enough, thank God, to know that the right place for me and the important place for me to come from when I approached Esther Wilding was, again, to go exactly back to being 14 on a Saturday afternoon and feeling like I was flying because I was telling a story.
Mm.
And that's the mindset I had in approaching it. Then 2020 happened. Which, as somebody who has done one of the longest lockdowns in the world, Kate, you know, we don't need to talk about 2020 too much. But it meant that Sam and I had flown home at the end of 2019 for Christmas and for me to make Back to Nature, the film Back to Nature. Mm-hmm. 2020 happened. We were grounded in Australia. The world shut down. I had 3 years of inspiration and research gathered on bookshelves for Esther in Manchester, and I was not going to be able to get back to them to write her. I had a month-long trip to the Faroe Islands booked in July of 2020. That was cancelled. My trip to Copenhagen cancelled for research. So August 2020, it was like, I need to start writing my second novel. How am I going to do this? The biggest thing was, I can't write country I haven't had my own 2 feet on and breathed in and seen and felt on my skin and connected with through its stories. And I can't do that. And I, you know, again, it's just, there was the lesson that with enough work and imagination and research and respect for what you're researching, what you think is impossible can be possible. So I wrote it. I bought a caravan and put it on the paddock in my beautiful parents. I mean, we're still here. I'm in, like, you know, Sam and I, you know, they're so beautiful. My mum and stepdad retired. And at the same time that they retired, they essentially have two grown adults.
I love this so much. Come
into their house. And I've essentially, like, if I could take you and show you, I've just sprawled, like, the hundreds of books, the research, like, I've just sprawled through their house. I've got a caravan in one of their paddocks. But they, you know, I had this little nucleus of support in my parents and Sam and 5 dogs on Jugendbear land where I am. And it was a do or die feeling, Kate. It was like, everything feels really like going back to, for all of us with, I mean, not to dwell on it for any of us for too long, but how incredibly terrifying 2020 was for everybody in the world, and how much loss was felt in multiple, innumerable contexts and ways. And as all of that was shutting down and anxiety and stress as a result were rising, there were so many days where my brain just didn't feel like it actually didn't work. Like, I didn't feel like I had mental health, let alone an imagination that I could tap into. But when I reflect now, I wrote Esther Wilding sort of in these frantic chunks. I think I did the first 20,000 words between filming Back to Nature in 2020. And I was driven to do that because before the pandemic hit, I signed a book deal with HarperCollins that, you know, so I'm legally bound to the, and the, I don't know, like, would I have written a novel if I didn't have that at my back? I I mean, I don't want to like instill self-doubt in myself, but I mean, there were many days where it was too hard to get up and remember to put your knickers on through lockdown and COVID, you know, like, so that I had that at my back. That was the driving force. So I wrote 20,000 words in between finishing filming Back to Nature, because all of that was thrown into disruption from border closures and that sort of thing. And then I picked up again at the beginning of 2021, and I wrote I wrote fits and spurts until about August again, where I did a huge chunk between August and October. Then I had this is a ridiculous thing to say, and my face feels funny when I say this. Then I had to go onto set to watch Lost Flowers be filmed. I was invited on set to watch Lost Flowers, the series, be filmed. So I was away from the manuscript for a month then. And then I had a big regrouping with Catherine, my publisher, because we have edited and made this book together in a really unorthodox way because it was, as I said, all in these fits and spurts. Then I finished the last sort of 50,000 words at the beginning of this year, handed it into Catherine in March, and got COVID the same day and sort of went to bed.
Oh my God.
So that in a nutshell is how was it to write S.E.Y.L.D.
It's the curiosity, it's the awe and the astonishment, I think, is what strikes me in all of your writing and also your interactions with the world, is this ongoing kind of like wow factor at the fact that you get to be in this world and looking at this stuff. So how do you draw all of that stuff together? How do you make it all fit into a story like Esther? How did you bring it into her core?
I think a lot about the meaning of beauty and joy and awe and wonder. What do they mean? What roles do they play in our lives and our experience as human beings? And I think if I can really oversimplify things, so much about art and curiosity and imagination was taken out of our Eurocentric culture after the Industrial Revolution, you know, where science and progress became the forefront of thinking. Because I went once before Alice came out, I went and did a retreat when I was living in the UK, I went and did a retreat in Holland on self-compassion and how different self-compassion is to self-esteem, because self-compassion is about not abandoning yourself through the good and the bad. And in one of our sessions on this self-compassion retreat, the clinical psychiatrist who was there said to somebody in the room, as far as I know, I was the only artist that was there. Everybody else that was attending was clinicians themselves, trainers, facilitators, people coming to get like pop-ups, you know, on techniques to help other people. And I was there because I wanted to understand self-compassion with myself, but also in the characters that I write, what role and how self-compassion shows up. And the point of this story is the clinical psychiatrist that was leading a session turned around and said to everybody, what is the meaning of life? And there's that moment where you all kind of roll your eyes and you're like, oh, I'm at a self-compassion retreat. Like, this is the first thing. But he was so, he just sort of sat really quietly and looked at us and he said, it's to feel. And because as far as we know, we are the only species on the planet that has an imagination that is connected to our emotional, nervous system. And so when we talk about weaving everything in, I think where that all comes from is the extraordinary beauty that we can all observe in the world and that we make and put in the world. And what does it say? What do our observations of it say about who we are? How can I tell you who Esther is without knocking you over the head with it and saying, Esther is feeling this, but instead I can show you how she perceives the landscapes of the Faroe Islands and what they remind her of. And what she feels when she looks at them, or how it feels for Esther to sit on the beach filled with reverence and awe and wonder and respect for a culture outside of her own, knowing that her place is not to be engaged in the act of gathering shells or making shell necklaces, but the awe and wonder is to be aside it, to be respectful of it, to bear witness to it. And I think that weaving all of that in, the astronomy, the art, the stories, to me, it just feels like it. If we scratch the surface on any of us, we are made of stories and of what matters most to us. And we all have those little idiosyncrasies, like S's dad, Jack, you know, he makes up space club for Esther when she's a kid so that she doesn't feel left behind by her older sister outgrowing her. And Jack's like, you know, because Jack loves the stars. Mm. So he's like, you know, space club. And Esther at like 12 is like, oh, space club. And I guess it all comes from just trying to humanize everybody through the things, humanize the characters through the things that they love and all of our weirdness.
Mm.
Like the beauty of our weirdness,
mm-hmm.
you know, like whether it's Esther staying with a really reserved relative in Copenhagen, Abalone, who like seems very sort of standoffish, but then you go into her house and it's this lavish creation that Abalone has tended to make her home feel beautiful for her. Or Esther goes to the Faroe Islands and she finds herself sort of totally in love with this family of outliers who are sort of to the left of stereotypical general Faroese culture. And I think the motivation, Kate, was that one of the greatest joys, like I'm 42 years old and one of the greatest joys in my life is when you meet someone you don't know and you can very quickly fly your freak flag with them.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yeah.
You can sit together on the side of a green room at a writer's festival, or you're at a concert, or you're at a venue, or a party, or a dinner thing, or a get together, or a picnic, or the checkout line at the supermarket. And the way that we put ourselves together can relax a little bit and we show ourselves our weird.
Mm.
And the weird is so beautiful. And it's filled for me with awe, wonder and joy. And I think that was my motivation, that instead of like when I was writing Esther Wilding, and it thrills me to the point of wobbly knees to know how you've responded. So thank you. Yeah,
thank you.
Because it feels so wonderful that all of those things that these characters and I decided that they loved has come across as showing you who they are.
Mm. I've actually spent this morning reading about shell stringing. Can you pronounce the correct word for me? The like word in language?
Kanalaritja.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think one of the things that you do so well, and you've just described it too, as bearing witness, as sitting on the outside and looking respectfully at another culture, is the work and the research and the collaboration and the permission seeking that you need to do to include these stories from other cultures, ones that are part of your ancestry, I know, with Scandinavian stories, and also with First Nations culture. And it does, as I was writing this question, I feel like it's a bit reductive to pull this part out and ask you, but I know so many of our listeners do, is when you know that you want to include something like the shell stringing, or Pakana language, which you've talked about in your acknowledgements as well. What are your first steps to making sure that you do that well and you do that respectfully and you bring it with this joy and wonder that means that your readers go out and go, oh my gosh, tell me more about this and what I want to do with this information?
Gorgeous. First steps. I think for me personally, a great gift and honor that I have in my past experience and learning is that I lived for a number of years in my 20s in an Aboriginal community in the Northern Territory where I lived and worked. And that experience blew apart and restructured my public schooling and the world that the very white Australian public schooling and world that I lived in growing up on the Gold Coast in the 80s and 90s. Mm. So I mention that because that really is the bedrock of my relearning and understanding, beginning to understand Australia's true history and how the nation has been made. That's a very simplified way to say that. But living in the Northern Territory in this community, that's the point, is that that was the beginning. Living and working there was the beginning of really getting a grasp on what I had never learned about being on this land as an Australian, being on this country. So a lot of Lost Flowers was drawn from personal experience having lived there and conversations that I'd had with Anangu women that I had the gift and honour of living and working with and getting to know. Mm. Writing Esther Wilding, I wanted to take that with me into writing a story set in La Truwitha, Tasmania, knowing that I had no interest in contributing to whitewashing another story about that island and about this country. Mm. So first steps for me was thinking about how I would write Takana women, who they would be, questioning wherever possible any sort of unconscious bias, which is a really strange thing to say, because how can you interrogate something that's unconscious? But also, you know, if you have got a bit of awareness, you can also call bullshit on yourself quite easily. You know, we've got our own bullshit meters. So before I approached anybody in La Truwitha, in the Pakana community, I did as much work as I could to, I had the whole draft written, and I had the characters of Nin, Queenie, Auntie Ro, and stories from Pakana women history embedded through the novel, with mention of Kana Laracha, the shell stringing. So I'd done as much research as I could before I engaged with the community to ask for consultation and things like, you know, please read this and guide me, that sort of thing. I also, before I contacted the community, I also had the sort of first and biggest connecting was I started the I'm going to try and like talk it down, but this is a bold-faced lie, my very just mild obsession with shell necklaces. So I, you know, found, because I went to at the beginning of 2020, I went to the water exhibition at the Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane. And at the water exhibition, I went there with Esther in mind, just soaking up all of that input for a story about women and water, and watching at that exhibition all sorts of artists from diverse backgrounds talk about what water means to their cultures. And so I'm soaking sort of all of this up and taking notes, and I had nowhere to be that day but at the exhibition, so I wasn't under any pressure. And I walked around the corner in the exhibition, and in this cabinet was this shell necklace. And I remember, Kate, I looked up because I was like, where's the spot? Where's the light? Like, where's that glow coming from? And the shells didn't have a spotlight on them. They were in the low light. They were just pulsating with their own glow. And I'm looking around at everybody in this room, and I'm like, is anybody else like what in the holy mother of God is this magic in this cabinet? So I went to the gift shop, and that was when I hadn't written a word of Esther Wilding yet, and that was when the shell stringing idea exploded into my mind and heart. And all of a sudden, the northeast coast of La Truwitha just sort of, and the women there just blew up in my mind. So going to that exhibition led me to Black Space Creative, which is a Black-owned business run out of La Truwitha, and it's run by Caleb Nichols-Mansell, who is just heaven in human form. And he curates and offers Aboriginal artwork from La Truwitha for sale. So I get online and I start buying shell necklaces, and it's a little bit like getting tattoos. I'm like, I only need one. And then Caleb and I developed a really beautiful friendship, because after about my fourth necklace purchase, Caleb wrote to me, he's like, excuse me, Miss Holly, I see you. And we just really hit it off and just had some beautiful conversations. And Caleb has been so generous with his time, and through supporting Black Space Creative and buying my shell necklaces, I started to meet the artists. So one necklace that I bought that was of shells and kelp was made by Emma Robertson. I contacted Emma to say, thank you so much for this beautiful piece of art. I'm honoured to be able to wear and look after. And then Emma and I started chatting, and through time, Emma knew that I was writing my second novel, and that's why I was sort of so fascinated with shell necklaces and the art of stringing them and the history, because it's kind of large, it's an unbroken practice through time. And so then when I had the draft written, Emma became one of the sensitivity readers that I collaborated with and engaged to read the novel. And I said to them, look, I am learning. I am here for whatever thoughts, questions, please feel welcome and free, you know. And through learning about Kana Laricha and gathering all of the research that I could on the exhibition that toured Australia a number of years ago, I found the glorious Zoe Rimmer, who used to be the curator at the museum in Tasmania. Zoe and I got talking. I asked Zoe if she would consider collaborating with me as a sensitivity reader. She said yes. Zoe introduced me to Auntie Teresa Sainty, who works with the Tasmania Aboriginal Corporation. She helped me with language and guided me. They read the whole novels. They fed back. It was really one of the most meaningful parts of pulling the book together was having that wonderful exchange and generosity and learning from working with these women and you know, from knowing that you can never expect one person or a group of a few people to speak for a whole culture or a community, but to do it right as much as you can about seeking the guidance, the consultation, the support from the culture outside of your own that you want to write. I think that was how it all happened. And likewise, I did it for the Faroe Islands. I also reached out to a writer and an artist who lives in the Faroes. Just like when we were kids and you'd write to a kid you didn't know and like, do you want to be pen pal? So pardon me, I reached out to Raquel Helmsdale, who's a Faroese writer and artist, as I said, and I explained to her in the same way that I explained to Zoe and Emma, you know, I've written this novel, and I said to Raquel, I had a trip to the Faroes planned. I can't get there. You know, can you help me as much as possible get it right? And she was extraordinary, gave me all this feedback and, you know, everything from you've got the light wrong at this time of year to, you know, you can't see those sorts of birds here at this time of. So it's look, I'm sure it's imperfect, and I don't walk around thinking, oh, I've got it so right. It's more just knowing that I did as much as I could to be as consultative as possible, because the option of not doing the work is that I'm just contributing to another white novel about people here.
Holly, that's such a generous answer. And I think the complexity and you showing us what the work is and the extent of it is what is going to be so incredibly important too for our listeners. What you show us there and in your wonderful acknowledgements is the extraordinary community who are part of helping you in your writing practice and in your writing life. And I think I was thinking especially about two other joy beacons, as you've been described as, Claire Christian and Brooke Davis, who I know that you are also dear friends of, that I would group in the same area of, you know, pleasure seekers and makers and holders of community. And I want to ask you, and I know it's a difficult question and you don't need to mention specific rock stars, but who helps you with your writing practice and writing life, and how do they help?
Blessings is such a problematic word, isn't it? one of the gifts, no, because I'm not willing to give COVID much. So a thing that has been very unexpectedly pleasurable about how life has played out since 2020 happened is that my partner Sam has been here with me, not in the UK, And we haven't been separated while the pandemic has happened. We've been together, which we're so grateful for every day, because there's been so many times in life where he's been there and I've been here for fits and spurts. But he came home with me and from England at the end of 2019 after recently having stepped down from his work in this charity that he was directing at the time in Manchester. Had that not happened, and then had COVID not happened the way that it did in terms of grounding us, Sam and I wouldn't have been together in the way that we were as I was writing Esther Wilding. Mm. When I wrote Lost Flowers, I did it sort of completely alone and I didn't talk to anybody about it and no one was reading it as I was writing it. It was totally contained to my physical self and my life. It wasn't coming out. I think that was part of why it was so hard. Mm. With Esther Wilding, I had sort of my favorite person in the world that I have a shorthand with here all the time, sort of stuck in this strange, grounded, make it up as we go along life, which has been an incredible place to be stuck with my parents. I'm so aware of the gift, that is a gift of that time. And I think I wrote Esther alone up until the point, maybe it's about 10 chapters in, 10 or 11 chapters in, where Esther has made a discovery about her sister on her own, which is what catapults her into accepting she will go to Denmark and try and follow the pieces of her sister's life that Aura, her sister, left behind. I think I wrote up to that moment, you know, like where she's on the internet and she, yeah. No spoilers. And I got to that point and it just felt a little bit like a volcano. Like I could not hold this story. My head was going to explode. Mm. And it felt like, I mean, you will know this firsthand in your own body, I am sure. You are walking around carrying a language no one else can speak, but it's consuming you entirely. And sometimes it just feels like, my God, if I don't have someone to talk about this, I'm not going to be able to sit upright to write the damn thing. So I remember really clearly the point where I said to Sam, babe, can we go for a walk and talk? And this started the habit of walking and talking. And Sam has such an incredible imagination and magic, big magic mind. Like he's sort of got this super creative way of thinking and problem solving. And without really realizing it or planning it, we started walking and talking Esther's life and journey into being until the point where we would be sitting at the kitchen table and my parents would walk past and Sam and I would be deep in discussion over questioning Esther's motives at the point where she goes into the bar in Copenhagen, for example. And my mum would walk past and just, it was like the look on mum's face was similar to when you're in another country and you're surrounded by foreign language, because Sam and I just developed unintentionally this shorthand together where I could be working and come out of the office and say, hey, babe, do you think Esther, like, would she text Sophus first? Like, I'm really feeling like maybe she wouldn't. And I have never experienced that, Kate, in my life and never with a partner. And Sam and I have been together. He's my long-term partner. We've been together like 13 years this year. We've never had that in our relationship either. We've never talked about. So it really was like discovering this strange superpower that we share when we come together to talk story. It was so wildly giddying to be able to talk about and talk through questions and talk through feedback and that sort of thing. So Sam was here with me sort of in the trenches, as it were, in person. And then separate to Sam, but connected with Sam, the other point in the constellation was Miff Jones, who's she's like, I dedicate this book in part to her. And the reason why is because she's sort of my chosen sister and family, and she really was Esther's midwife. Mm. You know, like there were days where through those 2020 and 2021 years where I would text her before going to my desk and just say, I don't think I'm any good. I don't think I can do this. And she was writing her latest novel at the same time, or editing. She was further down the track. So she was editing it at the same time. And she said this thing to me. She said, we can simply and do. And so between Miff and Sam, Esther sort of, I just kept on pummeling my way, not to use a violent description, but I just kept pummeling my way, a little bit like, what's his name? Andy Dufresne in The Shawshank Redemption with the little yeah. kick behind yeah. Rita Hayworth.
Yeah.
You know, and then isn't that our experience, Kate? And then you crawl through the shit pipe and then, like, you come out and stand in the rain. And Miff and Sam were like the they were the champions of the actual first draft writing.
Which is where we need our champions.
Which is where we need our champions. And then sort of waiting to hold the baby, to catch the baby, is my publisher, Catherine Milne. So those are the souls who enabled Esther to exist. Yeah.
Holy Ringland, it's like, I can't even describe what it is having a conversation with you like this. I feel like we need maybe a year to fully go into to
all the that.
Different I tendrils. I hope we do too. I'm going to finish by asking about your advice, and there's one part that you would give to writers, and there's one thing that I found which you've said and I love so much in terms of writing the novel when it feels really hard. And you've said, the main thing is unwavering in its sameness. Turn up. I remind myself of this all the time. Turn up for who you were when you didn't know how to find courage to try but kept dreaming. Turn up for the stories and ideas that you need to bring them to life. It's such a beautiful, perfect piece of advice. And I want to ask you if there's anything else or another wonderful piece of advice that you wanted to share with our listeners about the writing life or writing practice.
Oh, well, this is an honor that I don't take lightly. Write what you love. Write what you love without shame. It's so simple and it's so hard, because the world will tell us all the time what we should be ashamed of and how we don't fit in and why we aren't, air quote, normal. But if you love writing, if you're at your writing desk, it's because underneath everything, writing is a joy for you. It's maybe a new joy that you found, or it's always been a joy, but underneath everything, writing is a choice because it's a joy. It feels good. And so the outside world and the writing industry and the book industry, it all has its place. You know, whatever book social media exists, it all has its place in the journey. But between you and your story, it's just you and your joy and your love of writing and stories and the notebook or the laptop in front of you and your imagination. Give yourself that gift and write what you love. That's what I would say, because you can't fake love. You can't make up what you love. You can't force it. If you write what you love, you will have something alive with a heartbeat on paper.
I'm just going to make all these little cuts of your voice saying all these things just to play in my ear every morning when I approach the desk. Finally, dear Holly Ringland, can you please recommend for our first-time listeners a debut book, any time or any genre?
I would love to. I read this book recently. I went away and turned off my phone for 9 nights and I was by the sea and I lay down and I read without feeling like I needed to be anywhere else. And I spent that time in company with Michelle Johnson's debut novel, Finding Uncertain Miracles. It's coming out in November. Michelle is she's a writer that I struggle to describe, and a woman, I don't know Michelle, we haven't met yet, but she is a woman that fills me with awe. She is an ER doctor and a writer. And, you know, as if that's not enough, she's such an incredible storyteller. So I don't want to give away anything about Tiny Uncertain Miracles, but it's a little bit Eleanor Oliphant. It's a little bit Anthony Doerr. It's so human and messy with a little bit of mysticism magic in there as well. And I really loved reading it. And I still think about it. That's always the thing, right? Like I just felt I felt really refreshed while I was reading it because I couldn't recall reading anything quite like it before. So it's out in November, I believe, Tiny Uncertain Miracles. It's got gold on the cover. You won't be able to miss it.
What a wonderful recommendation. And talking about books that stay with you, Holly Ringland, your Seven Skins of Esther Wilding and every bit of the Faroe Islands and those beaches and Esther and Aura and all those women and the images and the fairy tales and the seals and the swans, they are just in me and with me. And enormous congratulations to you for what you've achieved with this, your second book, and have fun and joy on your tour as you go out in the world with it. I just wish you all the love for it.
Oh, Kate, thank you so much. And for such beautiful questions. Oh, it's an honor to have any airtime to talk about any of this. And it's been beautiful. And thank you for all that you do for writers and readers and book lovers. You know, you're a glowing incandescent star, you know.
Stop it, you'll make me cry.
I'm just really grateful. So thank you.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.